From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
At the Bush White House, a crucial vacancy. Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most.
Today I submitted my resignation as Deputy Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor.
Karl Rove, the President's top political strategist, will leave the White House at the end of this month. On To the Point, we'll talk with reporters who tracked the relationship that helped shape 6.5 years of American history. Some Democrats say Rove acted above the law. Some Republicans say he should have left before last November's elections. Also today, the Red Cross report describing CIA treatment of detainees in the war on terror with techniques learned from countries known to use torture. Did those techniques work? Did they violate international law? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney back with To the Point. Karl Rove will be leaving the White House at the end of this month. What's his legacy? What will the president do without him? Also on To the Point, The New Yorker magazine provides new information on the CIA's treatment of terrorist suspects. Is it a violation of international law? Did it provide useful information? First, this news update. After 14 years as the president's top political advisor, Karl Rove announced his resignation today.
At month's end, I will join those whom you meet in your travels, the ordinary Americans who tell you they're praying for you. Like them, I will ask for God's continued gifts of strength and wisdom for you and your work, your vital work for our country and the world, and for the Almighty's continued blessing of our great country. Thank you again for this extraordinary opportunity.
We work together so we could be in a position to serve this country. And so I thank my friend. I'll be on the road behind you here in a little bit.
Karl Rove and President Bush at the White House today. Peter Walston covers the White House for the Los Angeles Times. He's co-author of a new book, The One-Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Peter, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Will this, do you think, change the mood or change the mode of operation at the Bush White House?
Well, it's certainly a reflection of the mood. You know, these are the waning days. Rove was the final Texan in the White House, so it's a different crew than the president arrived with, and the kind of a growing sense that they're just trying to hold on until the end.
What does that mean then in terms of the president's agenda forthcoming? Has he pretty much decided to run in place?
Well, that's a good question. Rove had a lot of power there. He certainly had a great deal of influence over the policymaking apparatus at the White House. But to a large extent, that policymaking apparatus was pretty weak anyway, and it's not clear what kind of agenda they were going to have. There's talk of the president vetoing a lot of legislation now that's going to come out of the Democratic-led Congress. That could do something to galvanize the Republican base in the lead-up to the 08 elections. But, you know, I guess the biggest surprise is that a lot of folks were just assuming that Karl Rove would continue to guide that political office, the White House political operation, into the 08 election and perhaps try to go on a bit of a campaign to rehabilitate the president's image and put himself in a position to perhaps be more valuable to whoever the next Republican nominee is.
Well, he now says, according to his interview in the Wall Street Journal with Paul Chigot, which was where the original announcement appeared this morning, that he's going to give up political consulting. Does anybody believe that?
He certainly says that. I guess at the moment we should take him at his word, but I find it hard to believe. I mean, he's been involved in politics for decades, and he really since he was a college student involved in the College Republicans and then working for George H.W. Bush when he was chairman of the Republican National Committee has been thinking about building Republican power and creating a long-lasting Republican majority. And he actually had made a lot of strides in that direction in this White House. Of course, the big setback was the 2006 elections, which he had been arguing was an anomalous event. And so this was going to be his opportunity to prove that, in fact, 06 was an anomaly.
Mr. Rove told Paul Gigot that he was started to think about this, started to talk about it with the president a year or so ago. Was this, though, a surprise, do you think, for the rest of the people at the White House?
I think it was a surprise to a lot of people around the White House and Republicans, probably many of whom expected the first departure to be Alberto Gonzalez. rather than Karl Rove. But now that he's leaving, you know, people are saying that he'll be missed, and it's going to be a big vacancy and a noticeable vacancy there.
Again, Peter Walston with the Los Angeles Times at the White House. This is To the Point from PRI. Well, what would you say were the principal ways in which Karl Rove changed modern politics? It's often said that he did.
Yes, he did, and in a lot of ways that Democrats are now beginning to adopt. Karl Rove really kind of, with the climax being the 2004 re-election of President Bush, developed a system of micro-targeting to expand the Republican base, really using pioneering technology to find new voters and bring them to the polls in certain minority groups, also in certain places in the country that were not often targets for political campaigns, not just suburbs, but what he called and what many call the exurbs, kind of out the rings of developments outside of cities, where they tended to attract young white couples in their 30s who perhaps were not politically involved, but Rove viewed them as Republican voters of the future. So he pioneered that kind of technology. He also used wedge issues, ideological wedge issues, in a way that had not been used before, and found ways to put the levers of government in the service of winning elections, not just presidential elections, but congressional and Senate races as well, using government agencies, government grant-making, the faith-based initiative. These were all things that Karl Rove developed. Some of them will continue to exist and play an important part in Republican politics. I think the micro-targeting, for instance, will be a central piece of the strategy for 08, no matter who the Republican nominee is. And some of these, such as the politicization of government, have come back to hurt the Republican Party and President Bush, and for that you can look to the U.S. attorney scandal.
Okay, and as you said, the Democrats have picked up some of the strategies pioneered by Karl Rove. Peter Walston at the White House for the L.A. Times. Good to hear from you again, co-author One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. On our little later in our program, we're going to hear about the CIA, and in a moment, more on Karl Rove on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. Once again, Karl Rove will be leaving the Bush White House at the end of this month, 14 years after beginning George Bush's campaign for governor of Texas. Carl Cannon is co-author of the book Boy Genius, Karl Rove, the brains behind the remarkable political triumph of George Bush. Karl Cannon, always good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
Let's take it from the beginning, the race for governor of Texas. How did they get together? How important was Karl Rove 14 years ago?
Well, Karl Rove met Bush when Bush was the son of George H.W. Bush, as he still is, and he met him. He was wearing jeans. He met him at Union Station. He was sent to pick him up for the RNC. And he spotted something in this young guy right away. He spotted this star quality in George W. Bush, I think it's safe to say, before George W. Bush ever saw it in himself. And when he went back to Texas and he ran for the House, it's the only time he's ever been beaten in 78 against a Reagan candidate. And he lost that race, and Rove was an issue even then. People say he's got this slick Karl Rove working for him. But neither man was deterred by that, and they began planning the governor's race.
What about the governorship? Was Karl Rove as involved in policy in Texas as he turned out to be at the White House in Washington?
No, he wasn't. And he was involved in policy for another Republican governor, William Clement. But in the time that George W. Bush was governor of Texas, Rove had nothing to do with policy, and he was running Karl Rove and Company, and he was trying with a lot of success, actually, to denude Texas of statewide Democrats. That was Rove's calling then.
How'd he do?
He did good. When Bush ran, there were no statewide Republicans. When he left to come here, there were no statewide Democrats left.
You say he was the brains behind the triumph of George Bush. What's the president going to do now without Karl Rove, who has been at his side all of these years?
Well, look, that's the title of a book, and I'm not backing away from it. But look, there's no Karl Rove is going to be remembered as a great campaigner and a great mechanic. The architect, Bush called him. That's a very exalted title. But he did not have the same level of success in the White House on policy, Warren. And I think what Bush is going to do without him, who knows? I mean, Bush may be a lame duck already, but you've got a very capable chief of staff there, Josh Bolten, who ain't outranked Karl Rove, but only in title, and maybe he's a very capable guy. Maybe this will actually help them. Rove was not as successful on policy as he was in politics in the White House. I just think I wouldn't say inarguable. Somebody could argue it, but that's my view.
Carl Cannon again, boy genius, Karl Rove, the brains behind the remarkable political triumph of George Bush. Carl Cannon also writes for the National Journal. Grover Norquist is president of Americans for Tax Reform. That's a coalition of taxpayer groups and others opposed to higher taxes at the federal and state levels. He's also a major player in Republican Party politics. And Grover Norquist, thank you for coming back on our program.
Glad to be with you.
Michelle Malkin, very conservative columnist, said today about Karl Rove, not a word about the Harriet Myers debacle, about the Dubai ports battle, about stumbles in post-Iraq invasion policies. What about the illegal alien shamnesty, she calls it, which will be the everlasting stain that Rove leaves behind? Are there Republicans, including in addition to Michelle Malkin, who aren't all that happy about Karl Rove?
Well, I think you've got several things to look at. One is Michelle Malkin has a different opinion than Karl Rove or President Bush or President Reagan on the immigration issue, and that's a policy dispute which she can make personal if she wants. But as to other key issues, Karl Rove was responsible, as your previous interviewer mentioned, with moving the Republican Party from minority status to majority status in Texas. I mean, I know in Washington, D.C., where I am, everybody thinks the world begins and ends in Washington, D.C., but when states go from Democrat to Republican or Republican to Democrat, those have tremendous implications over time. And when you're dealing with a state the size of Texas, it has very important ramifications. So creating a solid Reagan-Republican state in Texas was a huge project line, which Karl Rove was a leader of, independent of Governor Bush and President Bush. But then at the national level, Karl Rove got President Bush across the finish line twice, in 2000 and in 2004. And there was every reason to believe that that wasn't possible. 2000, the Democrats were running Al Gore. He was a very serious candidate. He was running with peace and prosperity behind him. He, unlike Bush, he had run before for president, both in the Democratic primary and then twice as on a presidential ticket. So it's kind of like an amateur going up against a pro as far as the candidates were concerned. Yet Karl Rove, managing that campaign for Bush, did an extremely successful job. He also, and let's not forget, defeated John McCain in 2000, who was running as the war hero, the former POW, the guy with gravitas that the young junior Bush did not have, and who beat Bush in New Hampshire. So the idea that, you know, Karl Rove fell out of bed and elected Bush president, or was easy somehow, or was obvious that the Republican Party was going with Bush rather than McCain, that's certainly not true. Not in 2000, it wasn't obvious. And then in 2004, once again, you had a president who was in some trouble because of the boat anchor of Iraq, and yet the campaign got him across the finish line. And in 2000, 2002, and 2004, the Republicans gained House and Senate seats each election cycle, which is fairly impressive. So that's a very impressive track record for Carl. Now, when he got to Washington, was he in charge of everything in the administration? No, he was in charge of the campaigns. Some of the policies that the administration put forward, certainly issues like Iraq, were you know, in the vice president's list of project lines, not Karl Rove's. So those, I think it's a little bit much to give Karl credit for everything the Bush administration did or blame for everything they didn't do. You can give Karl Rove credit or blame, if you don't like it, for getting Bush across the finish line in the primaries in 2000, in the general in 2000, and in the general in 2004.
Okay. Grover Norquist, once again, president of Americans for Tax Reform. David Corns just joined us. He's Washington editor of The Nation. That's a liberal magazine in Washington. He's also co-author of the book Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the Iraq War. David Corn, always good to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Colonel Rove has been in the firing line from Democrats on the CIA leak, on the U.S. attorney scandal, on the email accounts for the Republican Party, on alleged political briefings to various departments of government. They have issued subpoenas for him. Will they be sorry to see Karl Rove go? Isn't he a useful target for the Democrats?
Yeah, I don't think he's leaving the bullseye. These investigations will still be going on, and they'll still, he'll still be part of the fight. Remember, they put out subpoenas recently for Harriet Myers, even though she's gone, and they'll be targeting him just as well. Anything they find on his misdeeds, if they do find anything, will I think still be a big deal. Bush is already at 25% in the public approval ratings. He's down pretty well. I'm not sure these scandals and these investigations can do much more to lower him. And I don't think, Karl being out of the White House is going to take him out of the line of fire. He's still going to be there. They're still joined at the hip in the public's conception of this presidency. And if the investigations lead to him, they're all going to keep pursuing him.
Let me go back to Carl Cannon, our first guest on this subject. Carl, do you think that Karl Rove is leaving the White House because of the heat, because of the subpoenas?
I suspect not. I think, Warren, I think he probably would have left earlier except for these investigations. Bush, there's an interesting thing about George W. Bush. Loyalty with him is a two-way street. And that means, and that's rare for a politician, that he demands this total loyalty, but he also gives a lot of loyalty. And in a way that sounds good because that's something we like in our friends. It may be a bad quality in a president. You had, he couldn't get rid of Rumsfeld. You had Andy Card, Mike Gerson, and Laura Bush telling him to do it. He wouldn't do it. And I suspect they had to wait until this. Now, David Corn's right. The cloud's not lifted, but the legal jeopardy was lifted. And I think they were looking for a time for him to leave when he wasn't being forced out. And I think that's because of Bush's loyalty to him. But that's an impression. I haven't done any reporting this morning on it.
David Corn, back to you. We heard both Carl Cannon and Grover Norquist talking about what they thought the legacy was of Karl Rove and what his achievements have been. How do you see his legacy?
I think it's Iraq. He brought to the nation George Bush as a president. There's no way Bush would have become governor of Texas or president of the United States without Karl Rove being there. I think right now the Bush presidency, which is the Karl Rove presidency, is defined by our blunder in Iraq. Some people consider it one of the greatest strategic blunders in American history. It could be that 50 years down the road, depending on what happens, people may look back at inaction on global warming as the biggest mistake of the Bush presidency. But right now, we're still stuck in Iraq, and Karl Rove is abandoning ship before the battle is won, and this is a fight that he claims, as does Bush, is essential to the survival of the United States. Yet he is cutting and running, so to speak. So I really think it's mostly Iraq. The economic stuff, tax cuts for the wealthy, and suppressing, the stem cell veto, and suppressing government science, politicizing agencies, even greater than they've ever been. There's always been some politicization. All that stuff will be part of the legacy, but Iraq is far and away the winner when it comes to defining what Bush and Karl Rove have done for the country.
David Corn, Washington editor of The Nation. This is To the Point from PRI. Grover Norquist, back to you. Do you think Karl Rove is cutting and running?
No. I mean, this is not involuntary servitude. He's not required to stay. I'm surprised. I assumed he would stay through the end of the president's term. But he's talked about this. It's been something he thought he might want to do. And, if you're not running the 2008 presidential campaign, and each of the Republicans have their own gurus and guys who do that, and people tend to sometimes say, Karl Rove ran the Bush campaign. campaigns in Texas, 2000-2004, he could transfer and jump over to another candidate. One of the things that allowed him to be Karl Rove was his relationship with Bush and to be the architect. So it was both talent in terms of running a national campaign and the longstanding relationship with Bush that allowed Bush to trust him and on some, you know, some difficult decisions in terms of campaigns. You can't jump over and be Giuliani's best friend or Romney's best friend or Thompson's best friend, even if you bring all the talent in the world to a campaign. So, you know, that wasn't an option, so it's to look at something else to do.
David Korn, back to you. Do you expect Karl Rove to turn up in the campaigns of the coming year?
No. I mean, precisely for some of the reasons that Grover just did. I'm not sure, you know, his talent is transferable. All the other candidates have their gurus who won't want Karl Rove messing, since they all think they know the key to success for their candidate. Plus, there's this little fact. As I noted earlier, Bush is at about 23-25% in presidential approval ratings. Why in God's name would you as a Republican candidate want to be identified with Bush's architect in the general election? It will be nothing except a liability to have Karl Rove around. My guess, my hunch is, and it's just a hunch, is that he'll work with the RNC on some global issues, perhaps in congressional races, and maybe how the Republicans can try to win back the House or the Senate next year as well. But I'd be really surprised to see any Republican candidate, you know, want to embrace him in a very public way. He may give backdoor advice to those who call and be a kibitzer. Maybe he has a favorite, and he'll do that more with one candidate than the other. But this is not a guy, if you're running in the 2008 election as Republican, you want on the podium next to you.
Carl Cannon, if in fact the talents are not transferable and if he might be a liability rather than an asset in the future, what does that say then about his legacy as a political architect, a mechanic, and innovator?
Well, I think my friend David Korn may be projecting. I don't think he'd want to be on the podium next to Rove. But look, a lot of Republicans still respect this guy. As you heard from Grover Norquist, Grover speaks a lot more for that party, you know, than either David or I do, and he still thinks he's got a lot of talent. But you asked about legacy, something we haven't talked about yet. But Karl Rove put a lot of energy into Social Security reform, and the president and he spoke about it between the two of them about 100 times in 2005. You had this war in Iraq going on. It wasn't going well, and I think it undermined this push for Social Security undermined the Bush presidency on several levels, and it hurt Rove's reputation in Washington. First of all, they didn't know how to proceed politically.
Carl, we're running out of time.
Okay,
I'm sorry for that.
The guy who didn't get the politics, and then you had this war in Iraq that was going badly, and they had said that was a crisis too, and I think it undermined. And so I think that the policy legacies here of Rove is what's going to hurt his reputation.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Obviously, we'll hear a lot more about Karl Rove in days to come. Carl Cannon, David Korn, Grover Norquist, good to have all of you with us. In a moment, CIA treatment of terrorist suspects. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, Norman, I'll be back with To the Point. At a news conference last week, President Bush was asked about an article in The New Yorker magazine. It details the CIA's so-called enhanced interrogation of terrorist suspects, details it more so than other reports that we have seen in the past, and it includes what happened with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the confessed mastermind of September 11th. Mr. Bush responded to that question very briefly. He said, "Haven't seen it? We don't torture." But the article says this, quote, "The Red Cross described the agency's detention and interrogation methods as tantamount to torture and declared that American officials responsible for the abusive treatment could have committed serious crimes," close quote. Jane Mayer is the author, and Jane, thanks as always for being on our program.
So glad to be with you.
Let's talk first about the Red Cross report as a source for your stories. Tell us about it.
Well, for 5 years, the Red Cross has been trying to get access to the prisoners that have been held by the CIA. The CIA's program is separate from, for instance, Guantanamo. They've held what they call high-value detainees, top al-Qaeda suspects, in secret black prison sites, and nobody's had access to them, nobody from the outside world. And so the CIA has been trying for really a long time to see what kind of treatment these people had been through. And finally...
You mean the Red Cross has?
The Red Cross has been. The CIA knows what happened, but the Red Cross didn't. And so the Red Cross finally got access to them this last year when 14 of the detainees were transferred to Guantanamo into military custody. And they were able to interview these 14, but what they found out has also been held very secret. And so they've written a report, and I was unable to get the report. I tried and tried, but it is really, really closely held. But what I was able to do was interview a number of people who've seen the report and to be able to piece together what's in it finally, and from that get an account finally of what the CIA's program consists of.
How can you describe it as briefly as possible? And number one, an ancillary question, where did they get these techniques? Where did they get the ideas?
Well, I mean, that was one of the things that really interested me, because it seemed, even from the start, so outside of the American mainstream, that our country would be basically treating people in a way that, as I said, the Red Cross is called tantamount to torture. The Red Cross, as you know, is a very conservative and very credible international organization, so we're not talking about some kind of wild-eyed human rights group here. And what they describe is a program of abuse that is, you know, very much a sort of a programmed, careful, meticulous, and top-down authorized program of abuse from the White House. And it's you know, in some ways it's chilling. That's at least that's what the people that have seen this report have said to me. And where do they get these techniques? It was one of the mysteries to me, and it has been for these past 5 years. And I think we're beginning to get a glimpse of the answer, which is in part these techniques come from an arcane training program inside the U.S. military that is for the special forces. It's called SEER, or it's an acronym, and it's a program that trains our guys how to survive if they're ever taken captive and tortured by unscrupulous regimes from, you know, enemy countries that would do the worst of the worst to our people. And what they do is they put our people through kind of a mock program of torture so that they can practice how they would survive it. And what happened after 9/11 was the experts in this mock torture program turned it upside down. They reverse engineered it, and they were asked to, instead of using it for defensive purposes, to design a program of interrogation that used the same torture program, only instead of protecting our people with it, we used it offensively on our enemies.
And this includes, in addition to waterboarding, which we've heard so much about, what else?
It's all kinds of things. There's a psychological program that consists of extreme sensory deprivation, where they put people in goggles and earmuffs and deprive them of light, and people lose all sense of what time of day it is. They have no idea where they are, and they begin to sort of spin out of psychological control. There are no sort of set meals or any kind of routine, and they are allowed to have, they're sometimes kept naked for 40 days. They're cut off from any kind of human contact for 40 days. Meals are just sort of shoved through a slot in the door. They're subjected to awful sounds. They are sometimes subjected to extreme temperatures. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed has said that he was alternately roasted and then sort of drenched in ice water. He also said that he was hung from a ceiling by his wrists in such a way that his toes could barely touch the floor. And this is in order to keep him awake. Sleep deprivation is a big part of this program, so that if he fell asleep, he would sag and then be in great pain. People describe this. I've interviewed some of the people who've been through the program, who've not the high-value detainees, but lesser ones. They talk about kind of losing their minds, basically. They also talk about giving up false information under these conditions, which is one of the things the Red Cross report documents, is that every single one of these high-value detainees claims that they lied to please their captors and gave out false intelligence.
I want to get onto that in a moment, but before I do, back to the people involved, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, described by many as the worst of the worst. They, 14 of them, were the source of information, presumably for the Red Cross. Why do people believe what they're saying now?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I don't really think that you can take this at face value necessarily. I think credibility is an issue that is sort of tainted this program from top to bottom. The Red Cross, I gather, documented what they thought were credible complaints. One of the things that made them think that these complaints were credible was that the program that each of these detainees described was almost identical, yet these detainees have not been able to speak to each other. So the people I know who've talked to the detainees or looked at the Red Cross report seem to think that it's a very kind of regimented program with specific steps that people were put through, and almost kind of sort of pseudoscientific, really.
Again, Jane Mayer is staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. Michael Scheuer was chief of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center during the Clinton administration. He's author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. Michael Scheuer, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, sir.
What do you say to this program? Purportedly, from not just Jane Mayer, but others as well, there was a lot of dissent and disagreement within the agency about whether these strategies ought to be adopted.
Well, there certainly was a lot of discussion. There's no doubt about that. But at the end of the day, they were found to be legal, and we pursued them. Several things occurred to me about Ms. Mayer's article. It's simply, why would any American care what the Red Cross or Amnesty International had to say when it comes to protecting America? The second thing, we've been now 5 years engaged in this, as Ms. Mayer says. And if it's not legal, the Congress has had ample opportunity to pass legislation or to enforce legislation that would stop the practice. And the third thing I find fascinating about Ms. Mayer's article, about the European articles, is they never look at Clinton. At least under Bush, we're holding prisoners ourselves and doing our dirty work. Under Clinton, all of these people were sent to prisons where Clinton knew they were going to be tortured in a fashion that far surpasses anything that Ms. Mayer has said. So it's kind of, you know, this is, for, at least for me, is getting to be rather repetitious and humdrum. If there's something wrong here, fix it.
Jane Mayer, back to you. A lot of points to respond to.
Well, you know, I guess I think that Congress has not stepped up to this issue. I agree with Mike Scheuer that they certainly have not played an active role. And I think that to some extent, there was a lack of knowledge for most of the people on the intelligence oversight committees. Maybe that they didn't want to know, but certainly a lot of them say they didn't know very much about what was going on. The ones that did, the chairman of the committees who were read into this program, I think felt that they didn't know exactly how they could react publicly. You remember that Senator Rockefeller wrote himself a little note on the NSA program, and he sent it over to the White House, too, saying, you know, I disagree with this, but I don't think I can speak out about it. So they're in a kind of an uncomfortable position in terms of secrecy. At this point, though, they are beginning to finally do something that, which is they are in some ways holding hostage the top lawyer at the CIA. He has been nominated to be the general counsel. He's been the acting general counsel. He's got to have Senate approval. And the Senate Intelligence Committee has put a hold on him because they are saying they think these policies are illegal. They're raising questions about this now, 5 years later.
Okay. We don't know what's going to happen with that. But Michael Scheuer, back to you. Let me read something from Jane Mayer's article about somebody who had read the Red Cross report. People were utterly dehumanized. People fell apart. It was the intentional and systematic infliction of great suffering masquerading as a legal process. It is just chilling. She used that term a moment ago. Is that what we have to concede is going to be necessary in the war on terror?
Oh, I think it'll get much worse as long as we have cowards as our political leaders in both parties. They repair to this kind of activity because they're afraid to use the U.S. military in the way that it can be used to defeat our enemies. This is a substitute. They don't want to be criticized by the international community for using the U.S. military to win, and so they tiptoe around daintily using military power, and instead try to win the day by doing this sort of thing.
Well, is this sort of thing then wrong, in your opinion?
It's clearly counterproductive because the politicians are too cowardly to defend the program they asked for. And in the long term, I think Ms. Mayer has the mix about right in some of her work that many of us didn't think it was worth doing. No one thought it was illegal, but no one thought it was worth doing simply because al-Qaeda's fighters are trained to lie and to fight the jihad from the cell. So they're probably giving some lies to the American interrogators, and they're also giving some lies to the Red Cross and Amnesty International.
Michael Scheuer, again, formerly with the CIA. Colonel Steve Kleinman is a former U.S. Air Force interrogator and trainer. He's an advisor to the Intelligence Science Board, which has studied interrogation methods and offered recommendations to the Director of National Intelligence. And Colonel, welcome back to our program.
Thank you very much.
What do you say to the counterproductiveness of these strategies? Do they work or don't they?
Well, I'll take the questions in reverse order. I don't believe they do work. Coercion, the concept of interrogation really is getting access to somebody's memory. Unlike signals intelligence, where you're collecting literally electronic signals in the air, you need access to somebody's memory. And if you think how fragile memory is, you know, you can force somebody to talk. You can use all sorts of arcane methods to get somebody to talk. But the question one has to keep asking is, talk about what? You know, do they have a clear memory based on being isolated or stripped naked or abused for 2 or 3 weeks? Even if they wanted to be cooperative at that point, one has to question their ability to be cooperative.
What about the legality? Michael Scheuer says he believes these strategies are legal. Jane Mayer says people she's talked to says they're not.
Well, if I can be so bold as to return your question with a question, I'm somewhat taken aback that this whole debate has centered on the fulcrum of legality without a question of operational usefulness. Why bother even really studying whether coercive methods are legal under any standard if there's no scientific basis and only the barest of anecdotal evidence to suggest that they're useful? And there's a lot more anecdotal evidence and a lot more science to suggest that they're absolutely not constructive, not useful, not operationally relevant. So we set ourselves up for a big fall in the international scene. We set ourselves up for a legal debate that will go on forever without, I guess, with an assumption built in that whether we should or should not torture is a question. The question is, does it work? And I submit that it doesn't.
But Michael Scheuer, I gather from what you said earlier, you don't think it does either.
I question whether it does, and on a consistent basis, sir. I certainly think at some point it has worked. And I wouldn't call it torture, but I think it has worked. But on the whole, I don't think it's a very useful endeavor. But ultimately, the intelligence services and the U.S. military are in charge with protecting the United States at the direction of political leaders. And I would suggest that the political leaders in our country in both parties are so desperate to not use U.S. military power that they turn to this kind of thing, whether there's a scientific basis for it or not. And I suspect they will continue to do that in the future.
Okay, that's a different argument, and I won't take you up on it at the moment. I want to go back to Jane Mayer, the staff writer at The New Yorker, on this issue of legality, because some of the people that you talked to suggested that because this was top-down, approved at the White House, as you indicated, that very high-level officials may have committed serious crimes. Who are they?
Well, I mean, this program is kind of the opposite of Abu Ghraib, in a way. Abu Ghraib was abuse that happened in the hands of, the lowest-ranking soldiers, and our government said, well, it was just kind of wildness on the night shift. It was nothing authorized. In this case, this program is authorized by the White House. It's authorized by the President and by the Justice Department and by the General Counsel at the CIA, and everything that was done in this program was done in a meticulous and purposeful way. I mean, there were dossiers on each of these detainees that were available to the director of the CIA. He could check in and see what was happening on any given day to any of them, as they were, whether they were hanging by their hands or being waterboarded or whatever else. So if this program is illegal, it's illegality that goes straight to the top of our government. Now, is it illegal? First of all, I got to say, I am not a lawyer.
Sure.
And I can tell you it's an incredibly complicated area, but there are certain international laws that our policies seem to conflict with, and that's where the Red Cross comes in. They're saying, you know, these policies are contrary to the kind of treatment required under the Geneva Conventions, and there's also something called the Convention Against Torture, which is U.S. law. It's not just international law, and it says that you can't cross a certain line in terms of abusing people. You can't cross the line of torture. Waterboarding in our country was considered a felony offense, and in the military, people were court-martialed for it right up through the Vietnam War. When the Bush administration came in, the lawyers reassessed this and decided for some reason that it was no longer illegal. But, you know, these are arguments for lawyers to have. I come at this partly as a political reporter also, and I think there are other questions you could be asking. You could ask, is it productive in terms of gathering intelligence, as you've been asking, and is it productive politically? Because I think, you know, while Scheuer and I probably disagree in some things, I think he's probably more hawkish than I am about what needs to be done with terrorists. I think he would also agree that you got to win hearts and minds. And one of the problems from my standpoint with the CIA's program is you've taken somebody who I think is probably as dedicated a terrorist as this country's dealt with, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and by putting him through this program, we've turned him into, given him a position to be able to say he was tortured and he's the victim. Now, he's somebody who has victimized our country, but we have kind of given him a public relations victory by doing some of these things. And to me, politically, that's counterproductive in the rest of the world. You know, how are we going to win over the middle ground, the sort of moderate Arab world, when we use tactics that seem barbaric?
Quickly, Colonel Kleinman, back to you, our former interrogator and a trainer, on this question of legality. Was it part of your training that if you got orders to perform the kinds of things that we have heard described so many times, which the Red Cross seems to believe and were, in fact, carried out by the CIA, would that be an order that you would have to refuse?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, without going into detail, I encountered that situation where I had to deny following an order that I felt was unlawful. And it had to deal with the application of SEER methods. It was just people involved who were senior to me at the time who did not understand the difference between SEER training for U.S. personnel who have signed up for that type of training and actually using it to collect intelligence from foreign nationals. And as a former director of the Air Force Combat Interrogation Course, we taught and we had lawyers come in to teach the law of armed conflict, so people knew what they could and could not do. But the part of my profession as interrogator that I embrace fully is that confluence of facts that what is legally proper, what is morally correct, and what is operationally useful all fall in the same point. You know, you can treat detainees, prisoners, in a way that does not stain your national character, but is also quite operationally effective. You look at Hans Scharf during World War II. You look at some of our interrogators of Japanese POWs, also in World War II. If you use more cultural finesse and insight into the human psyche and patients, and they were able to obtain incredibly useful information without ever violating the laws or their own morality.
Again, Colonel Steve Kleinman is a former U.S. Air Force interrogator and a trainer. Michael Scheuer was chief of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center during the Clinton years. Jane Mayer is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. This is To the Point from PRI. The question, which we heard earlier, of how to treat terrorist suspects very likely will not be resolved by the time that George W. Bush leaves office, not with the current Congress. As the campaign to succeed him continues, what have the candidates had to say? We're going to hear about that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. For years to come, it's likely the U.S. is going to be hunting and capturing jihadists all over the world. Some will be too dangerous to release, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but impossible to try as ordinary criminals. President Bush and the current Congress are unlikely to work out a legal framework for dealing with them. That's going to leave the task to the next administration. Jonathan Rauch is senior writer for the National Journal, and with a colleague, he questioned all the announced presidential candidates to see if they had any plans. Jonathan Rauch, good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Warren. Thank you.
You heard from all but three of them.
Yeah, indeed. Brownback, Romney, and Tancredo did not respond to National Journal's inquiries.
But the others did, and you have divided them roughly into four different categories. Tell us what they are.
Well, you've got two groups that Republicans tend to cluster under. One are maximalists, and these are people who basically believe during wartime the president can do anything he wants. These are the Dick Cheneyites, you know, throw him into prison, leave him there without access to court or lawyer. Giuliani seems to be...
Wait a minute. Does that include the kind of treatment that we've heard about today on the program?
I didn't look at specific interrogation standards. Okay. I simply looked at whether these people think that the government has the right to simply clap people into jail and hold them without court review, which is really the fundamental question before you get to how they're treated once they're in jail.
Okay.
Giuliani has said in private conversation that the president should use the authority to arrest U.S. citizens in U.S. soil and hold them without court access only infrequently. So that suggests he thinks the president can do it. Romney has said Guantanamo should be doubled in size, and he's really not sure if the president can hold citizens forever without court access. So he seems to be kind of a casual maximalist. Then you've got another group of Republicans, and they're softer line. They're not willing to go out and say the president can do whatever he wants, but they kind of bucket to the courts. They say, you know, let the courts figure this out for us. We don't need any big changes. That group would include Mike Huckabee of Arkansas, Governor Duncan Hunter of California, John McCain, who's in kind of a special group all unto himself because he's the one guy who's really led in passing legislation to do something about this. He's saying, let's wait and see how the new law pans out, and I think that's a pretty fair way to do it. So those are the Republicans. The Democrats, of course, come from a different place.
Before we go to the Democrats, talk about that new law. We heard earlier that it's been very difficult for the president and the Congress, current Congress, to agree on a law. What's the nature of the new law? What are we waiting for?
Well, there's been law on how to treat detainees in U.S. custody, which you've talked about a bit. There's been law on whether detainees have a right to plead a case in court for release under habeas corpus. What we have never seen, amazingly, almost 6 years into the war on terror, is a comprehensive law setting out who can be detained, for how long, under what circumstances, and why. It's all being made up on the fly in a series of court decisions and administrative procedures from the White House. Just a really remarkable, some would say, abdication of congressional responsibility, and one that I think is going to have to be fixed soon into the next presidency.
All right. If we have maximalist Republicans and we have casual maximalist Republicans, what about the Democrats?
They also cluster into two groups. One is the most hard line on the opposite end of the spectrum. That's the minimalists. And these are people who basically take the ACLU position that if you arrest somebody, either you try them in a court of law and charge them with criminal offenses or under a court martial, or you release them, but that's it. You just can't hold them because you think they're dangerous. That group is Mike Gravel, Dennis Kucinich, John Edwards, the most prominent of that group among Democrats, and only one Republican, a libertarian named Ron Paul. And then you finally got a fourth group, a second cluster of Democrats, and they're kind of in some ways the most interesting, partly because they include Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. But this group I call restrictionists. These are people who don't have a proposal for a comprehensive law on detention, but what they do want to do is put piecemeal limits on what the White House can do. So they want to say, well, let's close Gitmo, close Guantanamo so you can do stuff but not there. Give detainees access to the courts, habeas corpus that's called, which really just says let judges decide. Restrict who can be called an enemy combatant in some ways. Restrict the practice of so-called rendition, which you heard your earlier guest talk about. This group includes, of course, Clinton and Obama, who I mentioned, also Senator Joe Biden, Senator Dodd of Connecticut, and Bill Richardson of New Mexico. And this group basically doesn't quite want to say, here's what we can do, but it does want to say, here's what you cannot do. So it's placing limits on executive authority without ever really quite telling us what the president should be able to do with these people.
And a lot of these people are in the Congress, a Congress you said you were surprised to learn has never actually laid out these, what can be done to whom under what circumstances. So if any one of them were elected president, do you think it would be unlikely that they would make any move to resolve all these issues?
I think it's pretty likely they would make a move to resolve it simply because it's getting harder and harder by the day to make up laws we go along. Every time the administration tries to assert that because the president is the commander-in-chief, he can do whatever he wants, the courts slap him. So the president comes back and makes another claim, and the courts slap him again. The ground's being cut out from under the White House. Sooner or later, and I think probably sooner, the next president's going to say, okay, we need a law that tells the administration and the courts and the Congress what the rules are. That's going to serve everyone's interest. And if you have a Democratic president, of course, it's less likely that you'll have an executive maximalist in the form of Bush standing there saying, no laws, we don't need any laws, just let me take care of this.
Okay, again, Jonathan Rauch is senior writer with the National Journal and also guest scholar, which I forgot to mention earlier, at the Brookings Institution. Jane Mayer with The New Yorker, we've got about 30 seconds left. You mentioned the issue of politics. Do you think this is likely to be an issue at all in the next election?
Well, I wish it would be, because I think it's an incredibly important subject for the country to debate openly instead of having it decided in secret in, you know, closed back rooms. I think the problem is that nobody sees it as to their political advantage to take a position on this thing. The only guy who's really stuck his neck out of all the candidates that Jonathan was talking about was John McCain, and he was a real leader against torture. But it hasn't done him a lot of good, has it?
Thank you all for being with us. Again, Jane Mara, a staff writer at The New Yorker, Jonathan Rauch with The National Journal and the Brookings Institution, and our other guests, Colonel Steve Kleinman and Michael Scheuer, formerly with the CIA. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper, Francis Anderton, and Vanessa Romo. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point. Produced live and podcast is a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.